You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming today to Brookings. Welcome. My name is Merrick Gutman. I'm with the Metropolitan Policy Program. We focus on the economic and social vitality of city regions. And we are really thrilled to be hosting two of the new UK regional mayors here, as well as two US mayors for a conversation about a wide range of topics on the growth, the vitality of their city regions. In particular, trading relationships, but subnational action on a number of topics and the challenges of governance. So to start this program, I would actually like to introduce Michael Tatham, who is the Deputy Head of Mission at the UK Embassy. Michael.
Thank you, Marek, and thank you, all of you, for coming to this event, and special thanks to the Brookings Institution for hosting this excellent event. It's a privilege for me to be here. It's a privilege to see such a distinguished group of mayors here from both sides of the Atlantic. Now, I'm a new face in town, so I should introduce myself. I'm the Deputy Head of Mission at the British Embassy, and I've been in this job for precisely 2 weeks. I'm still at that nice stage, which I don't think will last much longer. Well, it's still permissible to kind of plead newness as an excuse for not knowing stuff. But although it's early days for me in this job, I've lived in the US before. I've travelled around the US extensively for both business and pleasure, including, incidentally, to the cities of Portland, Oregon, and Atlanta, Georgia, both of which made a hugely positive impression on me in terms of their vitality and dynamism, and if I may say so, simply for being fun and stimulating cities to visit. So it's a particular pleasure to be here with Mayor Ted Wheeler and Mayor Kasim Reed. Whenever I've traveled around the US, there are two things that never fail to strike me. The first is the vitality of local government across the US. I'm always struck when I'm traveling around towns in the US how often you're driving along a street and you see front lawns bedecked with placards urging people to vote for this or that candidate for a whole range of local offices. And I always see that as a nice indicator of the inclusive nature of local government and of how extensively the democratic impulse penetrates into all levels of local government. The second thing that strikes me as I travel is how much the UK and US have in common, whether it's our vital trade and investment relationship, our links in education, our shared passion for music and culture, or our rich history. And much of that, of course, begins at the local level. So in the United Kingdom, we see local government as a treasured asset to our democratic system of government. And that is why the UK government, in its recent industrial strategy, is putting cities, towns, and rural areas at the heart of its policies, because they have competitive advantages that will be essential to realizing our economic potential and our economic future. Throughout British history, individual cities have spearheaded economic, intellectual, or technological innovations that have driven our country's development, and we very much want that to continue. I was talking to Tim and James, the two UK mayors here today, earlier today, and was having a kind of interesting discussion to them. I was asking, how do you find that representatives of central government in London view you and your roles? And they answered me very frankly that some arms of government in Whitehall are very welcoming, some not so much. But speaking from here, from an embassy, from a Foreign Office perspective, I want to emphasize that we believe in local government. That is why the government is taking forward this process of empowering local government. And a key aspect of that is establishing directly elected city region mayors who will have new powers to create jobs, improve skills, and build homes. And now 33% of England, including London, has a directly elected city region mayor, an office which provides a single point of accountability for residents, an office which can serve as an ambassador for their area. This is an exciting new development, and we have with us today two of those directly elected mayors, Tim Bowles from the West of England region and James Palmer from Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, who will be able to talk about the opportunities that come with these changes. I'm very grateful, James and Tim, to you for coming over to be part of this event, and I look forward to hearing what you have to say about your early experiences in these new roles. We are confident in the UK that these changes will bring huge benefits in terms of strengthened local leadership and institutions and devolving powers and funding away from central government in London to the local level. We also see an exciting international dimension here. We see huge opportunities in connecting mayors and representatives of local government with their international counterparts. We're conscious that we have a lot to learn from each other. We can also do much to promote trade and economic links which benefit us all. And we've already seen that happening in the UK-US relationship at local level. For instance, more than 30 UK companies have made a home in Mayor Tom Wheeler's congressional district in Portland, Oregon. In Atlanta alone, we estimate that over 5,000 jobs are supported by exports to the United Kingdom. And just last year, Atlanta welcomed a delegation of female business leaders from the Northern Powerhouse region in order to explore B2B trade partnerships. So as we look, as the United Kingdom looks to a future outside the European Union, we're looking forward to strengthening and expanding these trade ties, because trade and business are the bedrock of this special relationship. Creating these connections takes vision and a lot, I'm sure, of hard work. I can't speak from experience, but my guess is that being a mayor involves having to contend with a dizzying number of issues, very often having to answer to the high expectations of the voting public towards local government. I guess at times it can possibly seem like a thankless job. After all, President Lyndon B. Johnson once said, "When the burdens of the presidency seem unusually heavy, I always remind myself it could be worse. I could be mayor." But I hope those mayors present today would agree that as an office, it's a fantastic responsibility and an opportunity. We've seen in many places around the world how passionate people at the heart of local government can make a real impact. So I hope that this is an occasion in which we can learn from one another how best to do that. Thank you very much. Marek, over to you.
I'd like to just invite all the mayors up to stage, and we will get started right away with the conversation.
While we all get set here, we've been working over the past several years at Brookings through the Global Cities Initiative, which is about strengthening the international economic connections and competitiveness of city regions through a wide range of activities. We've been doing research, we've been problem solving with about 30 U.S. city regions and cross-sector coalitions of government, business, and civic organizations. And we've also expanded with a real priority to engaging more international city regions, now approximately 15 of them involved in some way in these efforts about linking up and sharing common interests and collaboration on these economic agendas. Atlanta and Portland are two of the very strongest Global Cities Initiative participants. They've implemented comprehensive trade and investment strategies at a regional scale, and they've undertaken some very interesting initiatives and efforts. I was down in Atlanta very recently about how they can improve the relationships, the metropolitan economic partnerships with some of their sister cities. So I hope we get into that as we go forward with the panel. But first, I'm not certain that everyone knows exactly where the UK mayors are from. or what their jurisdictions look like. So I just would like to ask Mayor Bowles, what is the West of England? What does it include in terms of some of its strengths and more recognizable cities? Just give us a little sense about where you are from.
Of course, thanks very much. If I'm in the UK, I normally start answering this question by saying what we're not, because it's very easy to relate to people in the UK who understand where Cornwall and Devon and Dorset and the South West Peninsula is. That is not what the West of England is. The West of England is a functional economic area that is based around the two world-famous cities of Bristol and Bath. We're a region of around about 1 million people and one of the strongest and most dynamic economies in the whole of the country. And we're a region that's built on centuries of heritage and proven track records. Somebody I was talking to earlier said, yes, if you refer to being the home of the Matthew, it will resonate well in the US. But whether it's the Matthew, whether it was the SS Great Britain, whether it was Concord going back through different generations, we've been the home of that. But we're also the home now of a great many new companies, not just leading the world in aerospace and high-value engineering, but we're very, very strong in financial services, legal sector. We are leading the world in loads of digital innovation pieces. And the key, really, to our region is about new ideas and innovation and constantly driving those forward. So that, I hope, is a little pocket of history where we are. We are very close to London on a global map. We are to the west, down the M4 corridor. We have main rail routes. We're very, very well connected at a crossroads in the country with international access through the first West Coast port, through an international airport, and as I say, at a real crossroads. And that's really what's always driven our economy, and that's how it's going to carry on in the future.
What's the total population of the region?
Around about 1 million.
Okay. Mayor Palmer, same question to you. Could you give us a little bit of sense of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough?
Certainly. Cambridgeshire and Peterborough are about an hour north of London. Cambridgeshire, renowned for having the world's greatest university, currently the capital of life science and technology innovation in Europe, and our biggest trading partners through that are here in the US, San Diego, the Bay Area of San Francisco, and of course, Boston. The economy is incredibly strong in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough. Unemployment very, very low. Again, around 1 million people. We see ourselves as being on the vanguard of a new industrial revolution, effectively, where we are trying to replicate the growth of the 18th century, but in a slightly better way, of course, than was done in the past. So it's a very exciting and dynamic part of the world, highly reliant upon the brilliant university in Cambridge, but also on the technology success and the people of the area, which make it what it is. So it's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful place to do business, and it's a highly successful economy.
Your economic development directors will be very pleased with your comments. I'm going to come back and ask a question straight down the line here. There are obviously challenges that you all are facing. You are newly created governance structures as mayors for these city regions, and you have lots of assets. But I want to find if there's some overlapping interests between the US and UK mayors in terms of this competitiveness factor. And you're operating in a global economy with various assets and challenges. So in terms of how you are going to be measured over the next few years, and your economic performance and the benefits to your residents, what are some of the key challenges that you're facing and your priorities for your administration?
Of course. I'll have to kick off on that. The government have set us a simple objective, and that is around continued economic growth. Sounds very nice and simple. And in terms of how the government will address the success, they will gauge that on 5-year gateways. and that will have keys around continued government investment to us. So when you say how do you continue economic growth when you're in a region that's very successful, is we nonetheless have challenges that are holding back productivity. They're holding back inclusion, the way in which we can continue to invest and support into the region and the population there as it ages. So we're breaking it down into three very simple pillars, and that is around business and making sure that we continue to be a region that is a great place for businesses to either succeed if they're one of our global primes, whether it's in the aerospace industry like Rolls-Royce, GKN, Airbus, whether it's in the leading fintech companies or any of those other sectors that we're really successful in. So it's important we support our primes, but also that we continue to drive forward innovation, startup businesses. We work very closely with our universities as well. They drive innovation ideas to start up, to start businesses. So we're very focused about the business aspect. To include the people element, for us it's vital to make sure we're delivering the right skills to the people that live in our region, to ensure inclusive benefits so everybody gets part of that. And then it's an easy one, the big one at the end for us, which is infrastructure, whether that's delivering the new homes that Michael talked about earlier, whether it's road, rail and other transport measures, but also vitally for us, digital connectivity into the future. So our third pillar is very much around infrastructure and homes. So we're going to work hard on business support, skills, infrastructure and housing. Delivering in those areas will help us really make long-term benefits for everybody.
Mayor Wheeler, Portland is well known as a highly successful innovation economy, actually has other comparables to west of England and Bristol in particular. How do you view where Portland is and what some of your objectives are for addressing any challenges?
Yeah, very, very good. Thank you. And I'll just build on the mayor's comments because they dovetail neatly with mine. First of all, in terms of the economy, as you just pointed out, you know, Portland's economy, and I would even argue Oregon's economy, has been described as transformational. We have one of the fastest growing economies in the United States. Our unemployment rate is very close to zero. Our wage growth is going up substantially. So from a typical metrics perspective, we're happy. But the challenge facing those of us who are mayors either here or in the UK, I think is bigger than that. We have a lot of these large trends that are shaping our global economy that have profound social consequences for our communities. And as I look at my role as mayor and I identify what I think are the metrics of success 25 years from now, looking out long term, I think the cities that are going to be the most successful aren't necessarily those measured in terms of pure GDP or job growth. I think it's going to be those communities that address trends like income inequality, which is growing rapidly here in the United States and around the world. And while there is wealth being generated, how and where that wealth is generated and who benefits matters intensely. And I couldn't help but notice as I walked in today, I saw a headline that said Mark Cuban predicts the first trillionaire on the planet in our lifetime. And when I look at the cost of housing and other basic services in my community and how quickly they are outstripping wage growth, that is a concern to me from a social perspective. So number one, I think successful cities have to address income inequality. Number two, we have to have economies that are inclusive. In other words, you can't leave people behind. As we explore these new ideas around creativity and innovation, we need to make sure that everyone is in a position to participate. And some of these other social issues, we are hugely known for green tech, for sustainability, for our work in collaborating around climate technologies, renewable energy R&D, renewable energy infrastructure, and all the technologies that go with that. And we're already working closely with the UK. Just using Bristol as an example, Oregon State University, which is our one of our universities that tends to focus on energy development and energy technologies, we're already in a partnership with the University of Bristol around wave energy and wave-generated energy production. And my chief of staff, who's not here yet, I don't see him. So when I do this, everybody turn around at the same time and look towards the door. But my chief of staff was actually the guest speaker at a Smart Cities, Green Cities conference that was held in Bristol in 2016. And so, again, we're already working together and we're collaborating, trying to address not just the economic issues, but the implied social issues that go along with it. Income equality, participation fully in the economy, and addressing issues like global climate change. So I see it as a partnership.
I want to get back to some of those trade linkages and partnerships that you just mentioned. But, Mayor Palmer, are these comparable topics for you, or do you have other higher priorities or different priorities versus, you know, West of England and Portland?
I think the most interesting thing that I've found since breaking out of Cambridge here from time to time and speaking to other mayors at conferences around the world and being here in Washington is that wherever you have a successful economy, the same problems arise. So the facts that that we have incredibly high house prices in parts of our region, incredibly high wages in parts of our region, but also massive inequalities as well, is something that we all have to deal with. And we can only deal with if we, I believe, go back to the roots of the education system and invest heavily into all parts of the society rather than just into academic achievement, which creates a divide that's causing lots of the problems that we have around the world. So our issues are very clear. We have a successful economy across the whole of Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, but it's quite, in the UK terms, quite a large geographical area, not in United States terms by any stretch of the imagination. And we have to make sure that those people who are living in the north of the county, where the employment is high, but where the wages are lower, can take advantage of the wealth that's in the south, and vice versa. And our infrastructure that we have in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough now simply does not allow the freedom of movement around the area to allow people to take advantage. So we have to invest, as Tim mentioned, into infrastructure, and it's an absolute key driver to us because our economy is so strong and our lack of housing is so great that unless we put the infrastructure in now, we will never solve the problems of housing and lack of housing in the future. So that's the number one priority for me, is to improve the infrastructure of the area. I believe the plans that we have in place will allow us to become even more competitive as a global player, that we will surely become, although we are already, but post-Brexit, I think a free trade deal with the United States, that I know that that we want and I know that you want, and a free trade deal with the European Union puts Cambridge into a very strong position for future growth. But absolutely, we have to invest in into our young people to make sure they get the education chances and are not just forced, as they are in the UK at the moment, forced into an academic route that most of them do not need to go down. And so we've got to. Three points that you made earlier. We've got to make sure that the infrastructure improves to the level that people can move around freely. Housing development allows young people to get on the housing market. And investment into our education system allows everybody to take the opportunities that are there before them and stop. We have to stop discarding people because they don't fit into a particular genre for education.
Mayor Reed, you are now unencumbered by being mayor.
I'm
for
enjoying
2 weeks.
This so much.
Mayor saying, oh, that's not my problem anymore. I fixed all those issues when I was mayor. And you actually have been mayor, I think, if I add up correctly, in total a longer period than all three other mayors here combined.
2,920 days.
You have all, you got all the answers that we're looking for. You share a little bit of your perspective reactions to this and how you viewed the circumstances in Atlanta.
I mean, I think things in Atlanta, by every measure, are better than they have been in 40 to 50 years. On yesterday, Peugeot decided to place their North American headquarters in the city of Atlanta, which means that the three largest car makers in Europe, most successful, are all housed, Porsche, Mercedes-Benz, now Peugeot, in the metropolitan Atlanta region. The state of Georgia has the highest level of employment, period, since we've been recording it. And the regional GDP of the metro Atlanta area is now the ninth biggest metro in the United States. So all of those metrics are terrific, but like my colleagues, all of the good things that we say and that our economic development folks want us to say, Merrick, makes it harder for regular folks to live in our cities. So this entire focus on the success of cities is leading to the two big problems that everybody's going to be dealing with, and that's affordability and mobility. But I think that we're being a little soft on the need to solve those problems unless we do what General Odierno talked about in terms of recognizing inequality as a acute threat to the security of cities. So if you look at the attacks in Paris, you look at the attacks in Brussels, they were stimulated by people feeling like they have been left out. And so I fundamentally believe that if you keep having people push their noses up against the glass window of prosperity, eventually they're going to take their fist or some object and want to break it. And so every time I'm on an important conference with real people of achievement and leadership, we're going to have a much sharper shift, in my judgment, to taking these issues of affordability and mobility on. In Cape Town, South Africa, the average person in Cape Town, Merrick, is spending 32% of their income on transportation to work, to get to their job. In Atlanta, that number is about 16 or 18%. And so the reason that I'm at Brookings today is because we have to really take on affordability and mobility, not intellectually, but with a passion that understands that that is the threat to the underbelly of our cities as they become shinier and shinier and as more and more people move into them. So that's my advice, the little that I know, to my colleagues who have the best job in the world, because people still love us. I don't know about you, but I left my job with an approval rating in the mid-60s. People still feel an affection for their local government. Right. They still see the mayor in the grocery store and don't throw a tomato at him. And that's why when you see national politicians, they don't want to be on the national news. They want to be on the news in Cambridge. Because people believe that at the local level, we're still delivering concrete results, which is the best part of what we do. But I do think that we're going to have to move away in a sharper, more decisive, more passionate fashion on this issue around affordability. We launched an anti-displacement initiative because property taxes were rising so high that I went to the business community and said, I need you to raise X amount of dollars. And then I went back to two neighborhoods that were near the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and we guaranteed every homeowner that we would pay the rise in their property taxes for 20 years because they were waking up and seeing people like us moving right next door to them as opposed to being happy, Mayor. They were scared to death because they felt like at the end, a new person moving in was going to mean what? They were going to have to move out. And so it's this kind of innovation that I think that we need to be at the tip of the spear at, and I think we need to put forward a little more aggressively. And I know that you all are going to be leading on this because you all have been helping Atlanta. And we're awful at this. So Atlanta has a massive inequality problem, but we had to get out of the Great Recession. But now we've got the best balance sheet that we've had in 40 years. And so now that we're prosperous, I'd like to see us take some of that prosperity in.
Well, I'm not going to ask everybody to compare their popularity ratings any more than I'm going to get into whose soccer team is better. But it's really interesting. It's not direction anticipated, but really interesting that all of you have in some fashion focused in on this question about an inclusive economic growth. And in part, it's because of the kinds of city regions that you all are in. We had this conversation with Gary, Indiana. It would be a completely different set of issues that we're talking about. But we're really focused on your talent, maximizing talent, making sure that your physical infrastructure, whether it's digital connectivity or transportation systems and job access, and some of the key drivers also that are continuing to spur your growth around innovation, which is the primary advantage that you all have in whether it's on the corporate side or the roles of your university as well. So I think it would be helpful to talk a little bit more about how inclusion, this question of inclusion and your economic competitiveness fits together, okay? And how you all view with the role of and your capacities as mayors to influence that, or any actions that you think you're taking that would be helpful. We can look at this from the role of the public sector, or you can look at it from the role of the private sector. And I do want to keep our emphasis on, you know, the benefits of economic growth, how you're going to continue to drive your economy, because we want to make certain that we're addressing some of these trade, international competitiveness influences. But I know Portland has been really deliberate about trying to shift the economic development activities to be more inclusive and yet maintain what's been unique about Portland's success in economic growth. Maybe we'll start with you, Mayor.
Yeah, thank you. And I want to first of all say I'm both inspired by your remarks, and I accept the challenge because I agree with you wholeheartedly in terms of needing a sharper focus. Where I disagree profoundly is in the popularity department. You have been a very successful and proven mayor, and you earned your popularity, every bit of it. I'm still in the process of earning it the hard way, which is one day at a time, and it is a huge challenge. And actually doing the work to live up to the talking points that I gave earlier is very hard, and it is very controversial, and people are incredibly resistant to change. So let me give you an easy one, then a hard one. The easy one is I have a board of economic advisors. They're business leaders, they're academics, they're community activists. They represent different groups and institutions in my community, and their job is to work with my economic development agency and our work system board to help us create pathways to education and job training so that people who have historically been left out of the economic equation have access to the kinds of jobs that are being created by the hundreds in my community, which are higher wage, higher skill jobs. And so rather than creating a displacement where we have all these great companies moving to Portland or expanding in Portland and simply displacing people who used to be here, we're trying to connect the people who are here today with those opportunities that we all know are going to come to the city of Portland. That's the easy one. The hard one is changing the look and feel of our community to reflect rapid growth, both economically and population. And we're in the midst, we're actually at the very end of a multi-year process to lay out the plan for our city. So zoning, FAR, how do streets look, how big are different neighborhoods. And we are trying to concentrate increased workforce housing in the central city core. And anybody here who's from a city goes, well, yeah, of course, that's what you do. That's the way it should be. In Portland, that's new. We're going from being a small city, or maybe I like to joke we're a large high school, to being a global city, and we're doing it quickly. And people are saying, you know, the doubling of the size of housing units in our downtown core is a serious threat to the things that they love the most about our community. And so it's a constant telling of the story about how this kind of development and locating housing close to transportation, to schools, to restaurants, to grocery stores, how this kind of development actually fulfills all of our values around inclusion, around prosperity, around anti-displacement measures, around the efficient use of energy to reflect our climate action goals. But there's nothing easy about it. And so I do agree with the mayor profoundly. It's the best job in the world. It is the best job in the world because you see the tangible results of what you do, but it's also the hardest job. It's the hardest job I've ever had. I'll just speak for myself. I feel like every day, it's like having your face blown off with a blowtorch, and by the time it ends, it feels so good, and you go to bed and go, "Gosh, that was another great day as mayor of the great city of Portland, Oregon." But you know, the thing that heartens me is in our very first answer, we all got right to the same conclusion about where we need to go, and how, so that to me is exciting. That at least at the mayoral level, in governance here and in Europe, there is a clear understanding of where we need to go. And we can do it at the local level. We can do it at the municipal level. It'd be great to have the federal governments on board with us, but if they're not, we can still do it at the local level.
Is it a similar circumstance for you, or is it distinctive?
I guess part of this from our perspective in the UK is where I am in the West of England region, I have three unitary authorities. What's a unitary authority? Everybody says, well, they're the people who, I'm going to try and speak American from this, who look after the sidewalks and look after the trash. We are not doing the frontline services in those aspects. So in a lot of the planning aspects around place, which I think are vital in addressing inequality, or lack of inequality, should we say, we won't have the powers to be managing those on the individual levels, but we will be over the more strategic piece. So when it comes to planning for the future, we have a regional plan about home delivery. The individual authorities will be the planning authorities who will pass the permits, if you like, to build. So we have different relationships in terms of our unitary authorities than a lot of the city governance in the US. However, the same thing still feed into this is, and I think it's been touched on earlier, one of the things we're really, really passionate about doing, and we've got some initiatives in place, are to highlight the opportunities in our region to those generations that are coming through at the moment in schools. Because those areas in our region, and I said earlier, we're very successful as a region overall, but nonetheless, we have got huge areas of inequality. We have got large parts of Bristol in particular as a city that are deprived areas, but it's the same in what seem more affluent cities as well, in Bath, is trying to ensure that people realise the opportunities that are there very, very close to them. Because it's very easy when you engage with people to say, actually, I can't become an aerospace engineer. Well, yes, our aerospace engineers are not necessarily all people who are coming from the region. We were talking earlier on about how many tech businesses are international in the way they recruit. But within those successful businesses, there is still a foundation of opportunity for lots of people. So we're going into schools with businesses to highlight the opportunities, if you like, above the obvious pieces, to show the next generations where those pieces are, how you can go and work. You can go and work for the leading football team if you want to. You may never be the star striker, but there are loads of opportunities there if that's what your passion is. How you can get involved in different industries and show how people can engage. And the other thing then around that is, again, we touched earlier on about the mobility aspect. It's vital now that we're able to actually link those things together. So where those people are, to be able to take them and allow them to access those jobs. By doing that, I think we can start shaping some of those inequality challenges, but also within that piece, and we talked earlier on, it's about not forgetting people as industries change, not putting people on the tip, if you like, once they get to 40, and the industry they've always worked in has either moved on or changed. So it's making sure people can access jobs as they're coming through schools, but also how we can reskill and train people as they as lives change.
I think we have this is a clear difference in the conversation, because you all, as newly created regional mayors, have a very different scope. And when we're talking about Portland, which does have a kind of metropolitan governance layer around transportation, or Atlanta, which is, in the scheme of the multi-county Atlanta region, is a relatively small core city there, although outsized in its political and business influence. There's a difference in governance structure that we're talking about between what you all mayors have versus the U.S. mayors. Because one of the things that kind of emerged from these two comments is on competitiveness and dealing with workforce and inclusion is the relationship with the business community and the responsibility of the business community. And it also is important when you're thinking about your areas as globally competitive. So I'd be interested in hearing some examples or your priorities and how are you collaborating with business leadership or not toward accomplishing some of these objectives?
Yeah, I think it was a very good point, the one I was just about to make. The difference between the mayoral regions in the UK and the powers that we have and those of cities in the US, as I've learnt over the last few months, is quite tangible. And our job is more of a strategic role. We have got devolved power from government, but we're brand new. So I didn't exist last year. And the authority didn't exist until November of 2016. So when we talk about a new governance, it is a completely new structure. And alongside the way that we're feeling our way into the role of mayor, government are also learning how to react to a mayor who continually phones them up and asks them for extra this or extra that or not. But when it comes to business engagement, I absolutely see it as a role of the mayor to make sure that the business community in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough is fully supported and that there is investment coming into the area. So we've just made a few changes to the structure of the governance in our county, and we're setting up a new business board, which will, in the interim, be chaired by my deputy mayor, eventually be chaired by a business leader, and include business leaders on the board, of course, and act on their vision for how we can invest into business opportunities across the county. Now, that's not something that's unique. There have been other sort of dalliances in the UK with schemes to try and get more business involvement into local government. But it's also had patchy effect, and I think that aligning the business board with the combined authority, a combined authority with an absolute drive to be business friendly and promote growth in the area, I think that the finance that we can invest back into Cambridgeshire and Peterborough is incredible. And I think the opportunities that will arise from our business board will be much greater than would be than there would be there if we were not putting that effort in. I also think it's the responsibility of the mayor to go out to the market and gain investment where possible and create an environment where international investors want to be part of what we're achieving. We're very lucky in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough because they already do want to be part of what's going on. They can see an economy that's grown year on year for the last 40 plus years, and they can see that it's something that is going to be stronger as time goes on. So we're talking to people who previously have only invested in growth in London, but want to be part of what's being achieved up in our part of the world. And my job is to make sure that I can guarantee their investment. So looking at some of the problems that we have, very high land prices, very high house prices, and changing the system so that we can take advantage of that uplifting value of land from development rather than it be lost to the economy effectively. Land value cap, I call it land value capture, is another way of describing it. But effectively, it's the mayor, the combined authority, gaining investment for new infrastructure, which allows business to grow, and not using the taxpayer to fund it up front.
Right. Mayor Reed?
My sense is what you're going to see is the mayor as minister model, certainly on economics and finance, move faster. I think that the challenges that we're having at the national government level in the U.S. and in the U.K. are making it more attractive for CEOs to work directly with mayors, whether they're in the U.K. or the U.S. In the city of Atlanta, if you want to enter a business arrangement or partner with us, we just had NCR open a 5,000-person campus near Georgia Tech. We've got the third largest concentration of Fortune 500 businesses. You need me and 8 votes at council for whatever we're having a conversation about. I think that that model is going to be increasingly attractive to CEOs across the United States. As it relates to Peugeot or GE's Innovation Center moving to Atlanta, it really was the leader of that business decision, our governor and myself, in terms of competing for that work. We were recently shortlisted as one of the 20 Amazon cities. Once again, that effort was led by our governor, supported by my administration and now my successor's administration. So I think it enforces the point that this is going to be more and more attractive. And then if you really want to be highly successful in this job, you've got to have the business community with you, because you can't love jobs and hate business. I mean, it's great during campaign season, but it doesn't work. And so in Atlanta, we actually have the British Business Consortium in Atlanta, because our biggest market in Atlanta was the UK. We have 125 British businesses. We have 5,000 people who derive their employment from our relationship with the UK. We've moved the city of Atlanta into the top 25 cities in the world for FDI, and we're number 8 in the United States of America. I have a group, or used to have a group 30 days ago, called the Atlanta Committee for Progress, which were the leaders of the 20 largest companies in the city of Atlanta, and they were the closest thing that I had, Merrick, to a board of directors. It's also how you get the stuff that you care about done. We were able to cut homelessness in the city of Atlanta in half, not because of any bleeding hearts, but because we were able to rally the business sector behind it. And so I think that it really creates and expands your ability. It is a force multiplier for a mayor to have a relationship with the business community that is genuine, authentic, where you're holding each other accountable. So I think it's the future, and I think you're going to see more and more of it, because I don't see our national governments beginning to move fast. And all of us, whether you're a CEO or a mayor, you have an egg timer on you. There's a finite amount of time you have to get stuff done. And most of the people who become a CEO or a mayor have wanted to be that for a really long time.
So the, and you all feel free to jump in if you have some reactions to your colleagues. You mentioned business and trade and foreign direct investment, both of you all. In terms of your economic performance and success for your residents, how significant is trade and international engagement for you?
I'll start. Simple answer. You don't very often get a one word from a politician, he says as he waffles on. Very. It's critical. The way business globally is changing, we have to start looking beyond our own boundaries, whether that's as cities or regions or nations. What I think has been really exciting for me, and I'm sure James and others will say the same, is when we've started talking more and more with city mayors in the US and other mayors around the world, is how everybody is saying the same thing. We're going to go away from national global trade, you know, UK PLC, to dealing with city with cities, developing those relations on that basis. That's happening all around the world, not just with the US. And that's why we're really excited as UK mayors to now have that opportunity. In the UK, we've tended to look at it more by sector as opposed to by region. So it's a great opportunity for us now by working, developing relations like this through events like this week and other times, about developing that regional city relationships. Now, when you start developing bonds like that, they become a lot stronger. They become a lot more sustainable. They become a lot more long-term. They will evolve and develop. So that's where I think there's real opportunity for us. We can talk at length, as we have been in earlier meetings today, about various aspects of the sort of political situation around US trade at the moment. But ultimately, it's businesses that provide jobs. We've heard that already, but very, very eloquently. And if we're all going to continue to compete on this global market, we've got to start doing it in a different way and improving.
And are you thinking, as in your new mayoral structure and authorities, is there anything that you are doing differently? Described, you know, it's a business council, doing differently to engage more internationally than the region was before?
Okay, we have something similar in terms of a business council, so we're doing something similar to that already, where it's a combination of the private sector, the public sector, and the academic world. What I think is interesting, that from James and my perspective, we're not career politicians. We've both worked in local government as elected representatives, but we've both come from the private sector. I think we see getting things done perhaps slightly differently to some career politicians. So for me, actually having the business community sitting around a table with our academic leaders and actually giving that advice, support to the politicians on how they can answer some of these questions is vital. Ultimately, it's the politicians who've got to deliver on that, but by having business on board, it'll make a huge difference. So we're going to go about tackling it in those ways. We've already got a small inward investment team. I am hoping in the new year, again, it'll be very small because we are one of those startup combined authorities in the UK, but I will be putting in place a small international team as well very shortly, once we've got some more capacity funding from the government, because for me that is vital. Remember, I said for me it's about developing businesses, ensuring people benefit from that, and the place aspect in terms of the infrastructure. So for me to develop business, I have got to and will take a much more global perspective and start developing in that way.
Mayor Willie, you've been at this for a long time in Portland, looking at Portland's repositioning as a more global city. What are some of the things that you've found or you're interested in pursuing more of? You mentioned trying to create more economic relationships where you have commonalities in places like Bristol. Are there any examples of this kind of transatlantic trade that you want to expand upon?
Oh, absolutely. You know, first of all, I assume people who come to Brookings in the middle of the afternoon are people who get excited about things like data. All right, good. I see a few thumbs up. So we've got a nerd fest going on here at Brookings. It's data, data, data. It's all about the data for me. And what does the data tell us? What the data tells me in answer to your question, how important is this to us? Very. One in four jobs in my city, one in four, is directly tied to international trade. So it is a critical component of my economy. And then as I look at, okay, well, how are people actually deployed in terms of that one in four? Well, there's interesting things. The UK is actually our number one investor in the city of Portland. That's great. And when people come from other countries outside of the United States and want to travel to Portland, Oregon, the number one place they come from is the UK. And when they come to Portland, they spend a lot of money. in our city, for which we are very, very grateful, and hopefully we have the opportunity to reciprocate. We worked very, very tirelessly with our business leaders. We have a couple of big employers everybody certainly knows, you know, Adidas North America, Nike, Daimler, others, Siemens are very active parts of our local economy, and they work hard to ensure that we have air linkages to Europe. And just last year, we were really proud to open our first direct flight from Portland to Heathrow, and that was exciting, and that opens up more opportunities for people from both sides to come into play. But what was disappointing to me as I look at the data, and where I think the opportunity is despite the fact that the UK is our number one investor, despite the fact that people from the UK obviously like Portland and they're coming to Portland as our largest foreign source of origin of visitors, you're only just barely in the top 10 in terms of trade relationships. And so I see that as a great opportunity. And I look at the things we are good at and the things that you are good at, and I realize we have these opportunities for collaboration. And as I opened up earlier, obviously around green technology, smart cities, green tech infrastructure, R&D, clean tech, I think there are some great shared values and great shared economic prosperity opportunities. And exciting to me, you know, when our natural resources university teams up with the University of Bristol and tries to figure out, okay, how can we go to the next level and actually do the right thing by the planet with a clean source of energy, in this case wave motion technology, and create job opportunities from this new opportunity. And I think you're going to see mayors all over the place driving the innovation curve and thinking about these interesting ideas. And you know, the former mayor of Atlanta is right. You have to work with the business community, and you have to have the good relationships. And they can sniff out BS like nobody's business. If you're not a serious partner for them, they're not going to play with you because they don't have the time or the resources to be engaged in a fluff exercise. And I think in talking with my chief of staff, hey, look, Maurice Henderson is here. Awesome. Thank you, sir.
Can you point to our watches right now?
He is here. He and I talk about this all the time. It's like we have to be one step ahead of the game and think about what's good for the pocketbook and what's good for the planet and what's good for our people all at once. And I have found the business community extremely interested in engaging in this conversation, which is good news for me.
I'll come back on that if I may before we... And I think this is where the real opportunity lies, and we are here talking international trade and local government from our perspective, because it is changing that way that the UK thinks, away from sectors and industries into cities and regions and developing those relationships, which feeds exactly into what we've just been hearing. And I think that's where we now, as UK mayors, have got a real chance to start making a difference in that. Not driving it because one company dealt with another, but driving those links between those two regions and really accelerating that. So it's a real opportunity for us to pick up the things we've just been hearing.
And we saw that actually in the Global Cities work we did with London, because... the distinctiveness of your regional assets, what you are good at, is not necessarily the same thing that Cambridge is good at. And yet the challenge at the national or state level, in Georgia or Oregon, is distinguishing how to support most effectively or align your efforts around what is the international competitive advantage of this particular metropolitan economy. And it seems like the UK is evolving toward that, and maybe you all have a structure in place now, a more effective kind of regional economic structure for them, the central government, to deal with. Is that
yeah, fair? I think that's absolutely true. The UK has been known as the most centralised government in the world. Regions have been pretty much ignored over many, many years, and the base has been in London, and the success has pretty much been in London. Doesn't mean to say that other parts of the UK don't add to the economy, of course, but the focus has been very much London-centric. what devolution brings, what the six new metro mayors bring, is the opportunity to break out of that London-centric policy, and allows people like me and Tim to come here and talk to you. And do we think international trade is important, is your question? Of course, we wouldn't be here in Washington selling our wares to the good people of the United States of America if we didn't feel it was important. Of course, it's absolutely key and will become more key to the UK post-Brexit than it has ever been. So I believe that you would expect me to say this, wouldn't you, as being a devolved mayor? I believe in devolution very strongly, and I believe that what we're seeing now is just the beginnings of what can be achieved from devolving power from Westminster to the region. Effective local government is the best way to govern. As Tim says, I'm not a politician by career. I'm a politician because I happen to turn up at the right time, potentially, and they happen to vote me in. But I never foresaw that I would be in this position, this privileged position of sitting in a room in the United States and talking to you about the great region that I represent. But what devolved power does is it allows people like me who've got a passion for their area, who really, really care and really understand what is needed for their part of the world, to actually get their hands dirty and get it sorted out. And it's not necessarily about going to government with a begging, asking for money and cash up front. It's finding ways to get the finance into your region, to get the business as strong as it can possibly be, and to provide opportunities for all. To going back to our earlier point about so everybody can share in the wealth that's created by business growth. So it is a new thing for the UK. I know it's not a new thing for the United States. But I believe that the changes it will bring will greatly enhance the ability for businesses in the United States to do business in the UK.
Well, actually, I'm going to open this up for questions.
Wow.
Uh-oh. I clearly waited too long for that. But it's actually, I was going to ask Mayor Reid a question, but we'll hopefully one of you does, and I'll go straight to the questions. But I just want to say that it is actually a little new for the United States, particularly in this topic. Devolution is clearly not. Right? No. But on the topic of international engagement and trade and trade, it has historically been seen as a federal responsibility, or it's been seen as a state role. It's as far down as it's devolved. And I think over time, and we'll probably get to this off these questions, over the recent time, this concept of city diplomacy alongside city economic development engagement, the responsibilities of city regions working with their business community for trade and investment has grown dramatically. So I think we're all actually evolving at the same time now. An introduction of who you are, and where you're from, in terms of organization, if you have. And please, a question, not a statement. So we'll start. The first hand raised was right behind the woman in green. So I'll take you first.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, mayors, your excellencies. My name is Rosemary Seguero. I'm a president of Wakamba and Gold Seguero's International Group. I'm based here in Washington, D.C., though I'm from Kenya. Thank you so much for your presentation. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, former mayor of Atlanta, for seeing you again. Looking at what this platform is very, very powerful. I'm coming back to international trade and international collaboration. Why is it that all the mayors, they need to come up like today so that they can discuss this growth? We have security, we have leaders, we have problems, counterterrorism, and all these things. So we need to have a platform with you and work with you so that you can meet the international mayors to come up and discuss this, because this is very, very powerful and it can help the world. Looking at immigration, I think you have immigrants in your countries just like here. Immigrants here, 80% of them are engineers, but you see what is happening. So how do we go about this? And my question is, how do you work with the SMEs, including them, women, young people? You talked about women, young people, and everybody. Inclusion for growth and development of countries. So I need your business cards, and I need to work with you so that we can make international exchange.
Thank you. Any quick reaction? Actually, Mayor Reed.
There are two good things going on. One is there is a work that Mayor DeLille, the mayor of Cape Town, South Africa, is leading. It's a global covenant of mayors. They had their first meeting in Stavanger, Norway. And so I think there's energy around the recommendation that you just made that's forming. The second model, I think, goes to Bloomberg Philanthropies, where the mayor's global covenant regarding climate. So there's 7,400 mayors that are partnering in that model. They represent 780 million people in the world. And so I think that that's going to be a real model while it's focused on climate. That model, I think, is going to be utilized consistent with the statement that you made today. So those are two stakes in the ground, I think, that you ought to look at.
And actually, I think, Mayor, the work that you've done on women entrepreneurship that has been replicated by through your international relationships, I forget whether it was with Cape Town or Lyon or...
So we have a partnership. You're exactly right. We launched a women's entrepreneurship incubator. We selected the first class of 15 women, and all 15 of those women's businesses are now continually in business, and we're on to the second cohort. We partnered with Cape Town, which had the oldest entrepreneurial incubator on the continent of Africa. And so they're going, their relationships like the ones you're seeing on this stage that are going on all around the world in a manner that I don't think has yet bubbled to the surface.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Contessa Bourbon. I'm freelance for the Wall Street Journal. I'd like to ask the mayors, what particular regulatory blockage in UK that impacts trade exports of your cities or region in UK? At the same time, what regulatory blockage or possible tariff that in US that can impact trade in UK between the two countries?
Well, I'll come back on that. I think, as I said, we're in changing times in the United Kingdom. We've made it very clear that, well, it's made been made very clear that that we're leaving the European Union.
Are you? I just wanted to ask. I wanted to make sure. Well, I got you.
Well, we could talk about this for a couple of months, but I just haven't got the energy. The referendum that we've had was binding until the next referendum that we have, which may or may not happen. But is that clear?
Yeah. They're crystal. Yeah.
At this moment in time, we're likely to be leaving the European Union. Is that
good? But don't quote him.
So as I said earlier, the opportunities that arise from that are ones for free trade with other parts of the world. And the United States will be, I'm sure, the first free trade deal that is signed. I'm very, very keen to see that happen. I'm sure that that everybody in this room is as well. These are the kinds of things that need to be unblocked to allow even more opportunities for both sides of the Atlantic. We've heard how much investment from the UK comes into the States. Obviously, it comes the other way as well. If there is a free trade agreement between our two countries, I'm absolutely convinced that all of us will benefit exponentially, not least, of course, my region.
Any other reactions?
It's one of those, I think we can, we're 10 past four, yes. I'm trying to think what time we've got dinner. We can go on a long, long time. So I'm not going to talk about the big B word and Brexit, but there are concerns, I know, certainly within our aerospace sector around protectionism. So there are concerns, certainly in certain parts of UK industry, with that relationship with the US. I think it's really important that in the US, trade is seen as vital, international trade is seen as important. And I know certainly with discussions earlier today and other people I talked to, that I think it's important that that message starts coming out here, this side of the Atlantic, as much as it's being driven forward where we are. I think from our perspective as a region that is very diverse in terms of its sectors and industries and reach, we've got very much a global perspective. So we are looking at different challenges, if you like, with different continents. But what I'm really excited about is our biggest increase in growth in exports, especially to the US, is in high tech and digital economies. Now, most of those entrepreneurs that are coming into that are people who are new. They haven't got preconceived ideas. They haven't got any hang-ups about the past. They're very, very positive and open-minded, and I think that's one of the things we can do. And I know that's not a regulation, but that's more an attitude and about new ideas and new people coming into exciting areas about exports. That's one of the things I think we can work on. But we could be here all day about specifics, I'm afraid.
But I believe your point about the trade discourse in this country right now and who is advocating for the positive aspects of trade and how important it is to our local economies is really significant. And that's why we see a lot of mayors who, again, have not historically been out front on that agenda, advocating for or articulating, communicating that message about how important it is, and we have to do trade in the right way, but we can't be too insular and go reverse. I don't know if the mayors want
to. The bottom line is we have to be a counterweight to this moment until this fever of anti-trade and anti-connection breaks. And I think mayors are uniquely positioned to help break this fever. There is a reason. I was one of the mayors in America who supported the TPP. Vocally and all the way to the very end, and was excited about having a trade agreement with the UK and the European Union. I thought that even our president, once he was elected, because folks campaign against trade, but once they get the office, typically they understand how important it is. So I think mayors are just uniquely positioned to deal with this turbulent kind of anti-trade time and to play the long game.
Yes, sir. I'll move toward the back.
Thank you. Anash, International Urban Alliance, Mayor Reed. Mobility, affordability, inclusiveness, they all require a regional approach. And my question is, how do you reconcile transportation, which is regional, with zoning and land use, which are strictly local? And is there a lesson to be learned from our colleagues here and mayors, regional mayors from the United Kingdom? Portland is a pioneer. We know that. And in regionalism. And there is another wave of regionalism coming. Thank you.
I really believe that you do it by spending your political capital on the problem when you have it. Elected officials have moments where they have a maximum amount of political capital. We just had the largest transit expansion in the history of our system because we spent political capital. And as a result, Emory University, which was actually not in the city limits, is now in the city limits. And so I think that we know what to do technically and intellectually, and we have the advice on what to do. I think that's when we just get out and have to have the courage to lead on the politics of it and be prepared to risk your job. And when you win, it feels terrific. And if you don't, I think you advance the argument. In the United States, when you look at major cities and transportation efforts, they almost always take two tries, certainly as it relates to regionalism, right? So the first try typically doesn't get it. It's the second one where there's got to be a politician that raises their hand. He says, I'm willing to spend the capital. And then our job really is to mold a public will. Your job is to tell us what to do once we catch up with the car. No, thank you.
If I could also just chime in and give a very timely and specific example to illustrate what I think is a great point. We have gone through a multi-year planning process on a multimodal transportation project in the city of Portland. And it includes fixing an interchange, it includes bikeways, it includes improved pedestrian infrastructure, it includes capping one of our freeways so that could be used for green space or other purposes. I call it trying to reconnect a community that was actually torn asunder by prior freeway development, and it needs to be called out that it was an African-American neighborhood that was previously torn asunder. So I see this project, now that it's come all the way to the end, as an opportunity to fulfill multiple goals. And yet, even though it started at our regional level, and this gentleman is correct, we have a metropolitan regional government that does planning around transportation as well as urban development and growth. And the goal, of course, is to coordinate jobs, housing, transit, all of the things that make a community complete and livable, schools, parks, grocery stores, everything, and encourage that denser, more economically and environmentally sensitive approach. But it's shocking when you get all the way to the end how controversial it gets, because people who want to stop the project, they realize City Hall is their last ditch effort. After years, and you know this, right? After years and years and years, they come to your door to try and stop it. And where are all my regional partners, and where is the state, and where are all the, you know, they're like, yeah, we did it. We moved it, we took the hard votes, now it's your turn at the local level. And you do burn a lot of political capital, and you do have to have confidence in what you're doing. So I think your point is a great one, and I just wanted to illustrate it with a very, very timely issue.
That's, I'm here to inspire you.
Right on the right on the table for us, sir.
Right there.
Everyone's looking backwards.
Hi, thank you so much for this important discussion. My name is Lauren Holt, used to be with State Department, worked on international trade and foreign relations and immigration. So my question today is about immigration and trade. Obviously, we had a big thing happen today at the White House with the mayors. How do you see immigration in terms of national security, as well as immigration in terms of hiring immigrants, hiring refugees? And I bring the question to the model of like Chobani, as a company and as kind of what you do as mayors. Thank you.
I'll jump first. So I don't even know if I have it yet. I think I still do. We're here for the United States Conference of Mayors. This is our opportunity to come together in Washington, D.C., and we meet with lots of people. We meet with our respective congressional delegations. We meet with people in the administration. And there is a group, a bipartisan group of mayors that was going to meet with the President of the United States right about now, I believe. Part of the conference, and it's really sort of a pro forma part of the conference, is there's a press conference to kick it off. And so CNN and Fox and MSNBC they all show up. C-SPAN, they're all there for the press conference. And they're probably thinking, this is going to be the most boring day ever. And then this comes out. This piece of paper starts getting pressed around. And what it is it's a statement embargoed from the U.S. Justice Department, with the word embargoed misspelled, demanding documents and threatening to subpoena 23 jurisdictions as part of blah, blah, blah compliance review. And again, you know, it's saber rattling. It's threatening to arrest mayors who have sanctuary cities, people like me. I pay my parking tickets. I abide by the law. But the President of the United States would like to see me arrested, despite the fact that I uphold the United States Constitution and I act in accordance with law. But what does this send? For me, I can handle it. I'm a mayor. I'm in a position of power. It's okay. There's even aspects to it that are a little bit comical. That if you are a new immigrant to the United States of America and you are watching the most powerful and influential figures in our country, our president and our attorney general, threaten duly elected leaders with arrest for upholding the United States Constitution and acting in accordance with law, what does that do to immigrants in our communities? What does that do to people of color? What does that do to people who have historically been on the outskirts of our economy? It threatens them, it terrorizes them, and it sends a terrible message to the rest of the world about what our core values actually are. And so I will take every opportunity, including this one, to reiterate that our core values acknowledge the reality that immigrants bring life to this country. And that immigrants represent the future of this country, and that the world is changing, and we will change our economy in accordance. And I appreciated the question that the woman here asked about what specific strategies are you employing to encourage the development of entrepreneurs and people of color and immigrants in your expanding economies. And I just want to assure you, that's front and center. And our economic development agency has reshaped itself and reconfigured itself around inclusive economic prosperity for all. And that will continue to be our objective. But again, it's mayors taking the lead. Where the federal government backs out of things like the Paris Accords, we're right there. We're doubling down on renewable energy and clean sources for our energy, our clean energy future. When it comes to immigration, our federal government is worse than AWOL. They're actually, I believe, acting irresponsibly, recklessly, and dangerously. Mayors will take up the mantle, and again, we will defend the principles of freedom and liberty that this country has stood for a long, long time. And I'll stop there.
This is making you feel better about your national circumstances.
No, I wish I'd applauded like everybody else. I do like great to hear.
Other questions? I'm going to take the question from way back. He's had his hand up for quite a while.
Hello, I'm David Smith of The Guardian in the UK, but it's actually a question for the two US mayors. I just wonder if you share the frustration of many around the country about the state of American infrastructure, roads, bridges, railways, and so on. And if so, where does the blame for that lie? Have mayors had their hands tied over time, and has Congress failed to deliver on that for decades? And are you hopeful for any changes in the imminent future?
I share the frustration. That's why we've gone on without it. But the bottom line is we've passed three separate referenda with more than 70% support for major infrastructure projects, including the largest expansion of our transit system in 40 years, and we've got the ninth largest in America. The fact of the matter is, I mean, the federal government isn't even fully staffed right now. So any mayor who's hopeful about a strong federal partner, beyond them not interfering with what you want to do, is a mayor that's wasting the time on their egg timer. In cities you have folks who want to move. And so through local referenda and the private sector, I find that if you want to move, there's a private sector partner that's prepared to step into the federal role. And that's what most mayors that I know who are really trying to move the needle. I mean, Mayor Garcetti in Los Angeles passed an increase in his sales tax without an expiration that has the ability to fund $100 billion in infrastructure. We passed a fourth of a penny for our MARTA system for about what will ultimately be $5 billion to $7 billion in full expansion. So most mayors that I know are just getting on with it. They're not waiting around for the federal government, because increasingly their dollar-for-dollar match is becoming almost not worth the challenge. I mean, I remember back in the days there were cities put in 20, the federal partners put in 80, then it went to 50-50. Now it's down to a lot of advice and complications right now. And so that's what I think the mood is in the country. I think it'll be a disaster if we pass an infrastructure bill that's basically a sophisticated financial mechanism as opposed to concrete jobs. So if you look at the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, there was $784 billion deployed, and about 10% of that was spent on infrastructure. The amount that was spent on infrastructure accounted for 37% of the jobs you could verify. So that's where they ought to be doing. But they're going to try to do some type of mumbo-jumbo financial engineering infrastructure package that I don't think is going to move the needles for cities.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I sense that mayors are highly impatient on this issue. Like the mayor said, we have egg timers, and the egg timer only has a few grains of sand in it. You're here today, gone tomorrow. So I was actually very inspired by Prop M in California, and it told us an important lesson, all of us who are mayors, all of us who have local responsibilities. It said to me that if you put out a bold vision for the future around transportation infrastructure, around the economy, around the environment, and Prop M included all of those aspects, if you put out a bold vision and show the public what it could do for you and for future generations, the public will overwhelmingly support it. Contrary to what was conventional wisdom, when they started talking about this huge $100 billion number, people thought that's crazy. They'll never support it, especially at the tail end of the Great Recession. And they supported it overwhelmingly because what they were craving was an answer to the question of where are we going and what is our long-term vision and what values matter to us. And the public didn't need to be told what to do or what to think or how to think. They said that's what they wanted for themselves and their families and their communities and their future. And the message to the White House should be, wow, there's something going on here, and we should probably latch on to this wave. But in the absence of that kind of thinking a clear vision, we'll do it at the local level. I want to quickly just mention one initiative, since we're here sort of talking about regional stuff. The West Coast got together a couple of years ago, and we created what was called the West Coast Infrastructure Exchange. Acknowledging that we had these just vast gaps in federal support, we decided to figure out what do we do if we work together as a cohesive unit. And in the spirit of the best kind of politics, we stole the model from somewhere else. And the somewhere else was the Regional Infrastructure Exchange in Vancouver, British Columbia. We based our model heavily on theirs, with their full permission and support. And that's going to be the wave of the future. It's going to be what I'll call micro-nationalism. You're not going to have the federal government acting. You're going to have regions within the United States that have shared values, shared needs, shared goals, working together collaboratively and figuring it out on our own.
I am running out of time, but I am curious, although the question was directed to the U.S. mayors, infrastructure is obviously a big part of your mandate. You both mentioned this up front. How does the description here compare to your circumstances and opportunities in the UK?
I'll try and be brief, but again, I could be here all day long. We in our region, and I think it's true of everywhere except the southeast. So I think it's true of all of our regions. When we look at the investment that we've had in infrastructure from Westminster, from central government, it has been nowhere near on the level that the southeast has had. Now, I think that gives us all a good reason to be going to government to say we are now in a position as regional government to be asking for more. I'm getting very good receptions with government when we're doing that. I'm particularly focused around suburban rail in our region, and I'm getting a lot of support from our Department of Transport around investments in that aspect. So I think it's a case of us going not with a begging bowl, but with a business case. So I'm going with business cases to government and saying by investing in my region, you will get a return. By investing in transport, you will see returns. So I'm not just going and thumping tables, making demands. I'm going, if you like, giving a reason why, a business case behind it. And we are now getting support by being a regional authority to do so.
But you don't even have the alternative of, you don't have the capacity, local capacity or authorities right. to self-help. Yep. The way.
That's right.
Any minor comments, Mayor?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got the fifth biggest economy in the world in the UK, and we are 25th when it comes to investment into infrastructure. So this government has upped its game and has begun to put more money in, but the deficit of 20 plus years of underinvestment is coming back to sting us. It's known as the Swampy effect in the UK. There was a guy called Swampy, an eco warrior, who stopped the Newbury bypass back in the the early 90s, I believe. And ever since then, government after government has been frightened of investing heavily into new roads in particular, but into all types of infrastructure. But that can't carry on. There has to be a finite amount of time that you stop investing into infrastructure. The reality is that investment into infrastructure brings back the finance that governments spend on it through business growth. We all know that. That's very clear. And that's the investment that we need to make as a country. Clearly, you've got similar issues here. Otherwise, the question wouldn't have come from the floor. And as mayors, as I said earlier, it is about trying to unlock finance from the local system as well as going to government to ask for money. Because if I go, Cambridgeshire and Peterborough, a very successful region, we pay around £5 billion a year into the UK stock exchange, into the UK economy. So if I was Cambridgeshire and Peterborough PLC, and I said, look, went to the bank and said, I need to invest between £8 and £10 billion into infrastructure in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough to make us the most effective economy we can possibly be, and we can then make more money, the banks would throw the money at me. But the government don't quite work that way, and understandably so, because they've got areas that are in need of investment in different ways. So I have to try and unlock finance from our own economy in clever ways and get investment in, as well as go to government and ask for money for schemes that will bring growth to the area. So it's a long-standing problem. There's been causes that have let us get to the situation we're in, but times change, and I think public's mindset changes. And I believe at this moment in time, if you, well, certainly in my case, if you run for government, local government, on a strong investment in infrastructure ticket, that's what the public want, because it blights their daily lives.
We are over time. We have covered so many interesting topics. I hope that actually this is the start with the regional UK mayors of a dialogue that we can contribute to at Brookings with our networks in support of others that are helping to increase the information exchange and the economic collaboration between among these leading economic engines for our countries. So I want everyone to thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you, Mayor.
Appreciate it.